Hi, I'm Kate.
And I'm Lori. We've always thought that the most compelling story strikes the perfect balance between an honest look at the mess of life and the humor that can be found in the mess. To be perfectly honest, we don't really know how to live life without both the humor and the authenticity.
Our podcast might be a little bit of whiplash at times. We can spin from hard and deep to humor and laughing on a dime. The hard will be really hard, and the truths we share are the ugliest of humanity. We don't intend to make it seem like it's all fine or to pretty up the pain, but we also know that the joy we found is all the more profound because of the pain.
So we hope you can stick with us through the ugly, because there will also be joy and hope and humor. Welcome to The Ugly Truth About the Girl Next Door.
Hi, welcome back to our podcast, The Ugly Truth About the Girl Next Door. I'm Kate.
I'm Lori.
And we are continuing on in our two-part episode. Last week, you heard us talk about family control trafficking and what it looks like and how it's different from other types of trafficking, and, you know, kind of what's out in the world and what people think of when they hear the word trafficking. And today we're going to kind of continue on with more information about that. So we want to start today's episode by talking about what is out in the world and what the professionals in the anti-trafficking efforts and anti-trafficking movement kind of know about, and typically the services that are offered. So, Lori, go for it.
Okay. So what we know is that there are some pretty significant holes in the understanding and availability of services based on an understanding of family-controlled sex trafficking. It is very, very important to understand that we talked a lot last time about that family-controlled trafficking has a very different impact and can also look differently because the parent is controlling the whole circumstance. So again, in preparation for this episode, I did a lot of reading. And one of the articles I read talked about the fact that during the trafficking process, children are more likely to report being coerced through physical means. That's 16% of the cases. Sexual means, 10% of the cases, or psychological abuse, 24% of the cases, while adults are more likely to be unable to walk away from situations due to debt bondage, that's 17%, or having their earnings confiscated, that's 35%. It's very important to understand that services that are being offered to other kinds of trafficking survivors, so if you're trapped because of debt bondage, or you're trapped because your earnings are confiscated, then the services that you need, so first off, the way that that's going to look is different, but also the services that you need in order to get free, you're going to need more like housing and financial support and an opportunity to be resettled somewhere else, or education, so you have another means of support. That is what's needed if you're trapped because of debt bondage or poverty. But that is not how family-based trafficking traps its victims.
Right.
And so unfortunately, the system has not necessarily kept up with that reality. I think, I don't know, that kept up with as if that's changing. I don't think it's changing. I think it's always been that way. I think the system is just now finally starting to acknowledge the fact that family-based trafficking is reality. But unfortunately, service providers often are inclined to use the same approach and resources for familial trafficking that are used for other kinds of trafficking. And that can be inappropriate or even inappropriate or even harmful. How could it be harmful, do we think?
Well, I mean, we've been around this horn a million times, right? Like literally the other day we were talking to someone in the legal system, and we talked about this in the last episode, but anytime I try to high level my story for somebody, a doctor, law enforcement or an attorney or somebody who is like, okay, give me a high level of what happened to you and what we're talking about here. They look at me like I have five heads, right? Because people have, this idea of family control trafficking has really not been entirely uncovered openly, I guess, you know.
Right. We don't talk about it.
Right. Which I have comments on that too. But
so we've had lots of conversations recently about the responses to when we try to high level the story, right, mm-hmm. about your experiences to people who we're assuming have some understanding of trafficking and family-based trafficking. Mm-hmm. But often the suggestions that are made, which we know are made in good faith, mm-hmm. but the suggestions that are being made are not appropriate based on familial trafficking.
Right.
There are things like, oh, does she need education? Nope. Thank you. College degree. Oh, does she need employment assistance? Nope. Have a job, have supportive family, have house, have all the things. So they're well-intended suggestions, but they're not actually things that are specifically targeted to family-based trafficking.
No. So I feel like the question that people are probably asking themselves is, well, if she has all of those things, then what services could she possibly need?
Good question.
Well, as of late, you know, protections and safety are a huge part of it. We literally have talked to how many people about, okay, how do we be safe in this? How do we make sure that, how do we make threats stop? How do we make them stop? How do we make them go away? You know, how do I like really feel like I've gotten out? And the answer is kind of like, well, like we have a shelter. We have like a shelter that right. you could go into. And it's like, well, no, because I have a house and I have a husband and three kids. So I'm not going to go to a shelter. So yeah, like there are things that we have reached out for help, you know, or like legal services, right? Like what we really, really need to find some legal services. But unless I'm,
destitute,
right, exactly, which I'm not, that is not really available.
Or how about somebody, a private investigator that will dig into some of the things that perhaps law enforcement can't?
Yeah. And I think that's I think that the law enforcement piece is kind of the piece that's maybe the most frustrating. Again, people who literally work in this field of human trafficking also are not completely up to speed on family-controlled trafficking and how it's different. And that has been a bit frustrating.
Right. So often people who are misinformed, even professionals, will misinterpret kind of some of what we're bringing to them because they're putting it through the filter of, maybe she's still struggling because she's financially entangled. Nope. Mm-hmm. There is no financial entanglement here whatsoever. And are you going to make the statement or shall I?
We want to be very clear that I have not ever and do not financially benefit or benefit in any way from any of the trafficking. I do not financially benefit from that. My traffickers do. They did and they still do. But I did not.
So again, I think that even the professionals get confused about trafficking versus the commercial sex industry, which I feel like, I don't know, that's such a weird overlap because mm-hmm. nobody as a little girl says, I'm going to grow up and be in the commercial sex world. That's going to be my career of choice. Mm-hmm. No, people end up there through all kinds of life circumstances, including their own trauma history, but an awful lot of people who appear to be willingly engaged in commercial sex acts who maybe are profiting in some way from it are actually being coerced, defrauded, or in some way forced into it.
Right.
So no, that is not Kate's experience. But a lot of the services and responses are based on the idea that someone is stuck in that world because of
right.
a financial need in some way.
Right. Or a housing need or mm-hmm. yeah, like they don't have anything. If they left, they would have nothing.
Right.
I've been trying to leave. I just literally can't get them to leave me alone. So it's not funny. I don't know why I'm laughing because I have a nervous laugh.
Well, and because, you know, I feel like we just have to keep explaining this. It's laugh or scream.
Yeah.
Like, no, it's not funny. It's not funny at all. We would not be doing this just for sheer amusement because there's nothing amusing about this conversation.
No.
However.
Right. So I think we should talk about some of the red flags used to identify victims of specifically family controlled trafficking, and just how it's, again, how it's different. Because, again, even the professionals out there in the world, I think maybe don't know these.
Right.
Is that the way to put it?
No, I think it's true. I think it's true.
Yeah.
So it's important to note that these red flags could be red flags of other things. So mm-hmm. these things alone don't necessarily mean familial trafficking is happening. But familial trafficking should be on our radar screen if we're seeing these concerns. Mm-hmm. Right. And so I think maybe you could, I'll read them. And then if you have a specific personal anecdote.
Okay.
So first, if the child or the person is never alone, right? So always with other family members. So, you know, a child is never allowed to be seen by a medical professional alone. So we understand small children, parents are always with you, mm-hmm. but typically from, like, I don't know, 11 years old on, doctors look to have opportunity to speak to children alone. Maybe not necessarily to create opportunity for children to talk about abuse or trafficking, but because there's an acknowledgement that there may be things that kids need to talk about, or tweens and teens need to talk about, that they don't want to say in front of their parents. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, that was literally never my experience. Like, that's news to me, to hear that that happens and that providers look to kind of do that. I don't remember. I mean, really, until I was like getting married and going to my own appointments, was I ever alone. I literally stopped going to the doctor from the age of like somewhere in high school until I got married. Like, I would go to like urgent care if I was sick. Like, if I got sick, like, I got pneumonia a lot. And if I got it, I would literally go to urgent care. I didn't have like a primary care doctor. And as I'm saying that, it's like landing heavy on me. Sorry. So I think a lot of people might ask themselves when we talk about, like, you know, they did all the talking for me, or, you know, no one questioned it because it was a parent, et cetera. They might be thinking, like, well, why didn't you just interject, especially when you were a teenager? Why didn't you just, you know, ask to speak to somebody by yourself, or tell somebody at school, or, which I did, but, mm-hmm. you know, why didn't you do every possible thing that you could to get out? So,
yeah. So, I mean, hopefully you've listened to all the other episodes and you realize that Kate did very bravely, repeatedly try to get help. And each time she tried, it made things worse, not better. So it's important to really remember that, what they had always said, remembering that from the time she was a toddler, preschooler, early school age, all the way through, is, okay, close your ears. Mm-hmm. What they always said is, no one will believe you. And by the way, this is because of you. This is what you're born for. Everyone will know it. If they knew that this was happening, they're going to blame you. It's all because of you. And so that was her, not only what she was brainwashed into believing, and please remember, these were Kate's attachment people. So that idea of that these are the people that, for better or for worse, Kate loved, like, it's complicated. And these are the people who were telling her who she was, right? So the reality is that parents are the mirror that children look into for their identity.
Yeah, people use the term like love-hate relationship so flippantly. I mean, I do too, right? Like, it's like I have a love-hate relationship with chicken wings because they're great and they make my stomach hurt. So, like, such a good example. Yes. But in this reality, that is exactly what it is. It's a love-hate. I love you because you're my parent. Please don't leave me because I love you and because I don't know what I'll do without you and because I'm attached to you. And so please don't leave me. And also, I hate you and I hate the things that you're doing to me. And I never want you to come near me again, but I love you because you're my parent. So please don't leave me, but go away, but don't leave. Like, yeah. So it's wildly complicated. Like I want to get out of the situation and I have to make the bad things stop, but I also don't want you to get in trouble. So figuring that out as a 10-year-old, 15-year-old, whatever, how do you figure that out? Right.
Yeah. And, you know, again, block yours maybe, because what I hear from kids and adults all the time is I wanted and needed affection. I wanted and needed love and attention. I wanted and needed relationship with my parent, but that does not mean that I wanted the bad things that the bad people tied to a very normal and appropriate childhood need. So the problem is that it is so entangled for a child who is abused within their family that love and abuse are entangled, and that attention and abuse are entangled, and that physical affection and abuse are entangled. Like, kids can't separate that stuff out when that has been programmed into them from toddlerhood.
So, and that's true in abuse, but I also want to just add, and maybe we cut this because maybe it's too much, but the idea of trafficking when there's abuse between a parent and a child, when a parent is abusing a child, there's that attachment, there's all of that. But then when you introduce other people into it, and now other people are participating in the abuse, are the ones doing it, again, you might think, well, why would you then let them do it? Like, you're not attached to these people. But the whole of the trafficking is, you have to do this to gain my affection. You have to do these sexual things with this man to gain my affection. And my affection also looks like abuse, but if you don't do these things, not only will you not have my affection, there will also be consequences. So it's this really, really tangled, like, I wasn't trauma bonded to every single person that came and paid for these things, but I was trauma bonded to the one that was, to the people that were setting it up, the people that were orchestrating it. And so it was, right? So that makes it really complicated.
I'm thinking about the fallout after your middle school attempt to escape.
Yeah.
And how you've described long stretches of rejection and emotional abandonment and also abuse that came as a result of the attempt to tell.
Yeah. Like lots of,
abnormal loyalty to the family.
Yeah. That's another one that I actually just literally today was talking to Patrick about how when we throw our kids' family birthday parties now, as compared to when we were still in relationship with my family, the level of stress of having to do it right for them and have really not caring about anything else except for what my mother is going to think or say is I can't even describe it. It's just,
it's an unhealthy level of worrying about keeping everybody good.
And just nobody can say anything about them negative. Mm-hmm. If Patrick would even breathe a word of your mom is nuts, I would lose my mind on him. You're not allowed to say that because that loyalty is legit.
Brainwashed into you.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think it's very hard for people to grasp fully the emotional entanglement of a trauma bond. Oh, and by the way, what we've not talked about yet is that the people who were physically hurting you and emotionally wounding you were also the people that would circle back around and be offering you assistance. Mm-hmm. And so that's messed up. I mean, how's a kid supposed to make any sense of that? I'm now injured because of the abuse situation that you put me in, but you're the only person who is available to me to help me feel better physically, to solve this problem I have as a result of it. That is a Stockholm syndrome. Google it. The idea that I am now attached to the person who's abusing me, even if, and it happens in adulthood too, that if a person who's been kidnapped, I think Patty Hearst was her name, you know, they talked about that she was kidnapped and she ended up attached to her kidnappers because they ended up putting her in a position where she needed them. And then they would, quote unquote, take care of things she needed. And that made her feel warmly toward them, even though they were her kidnappers. So when that begins very young in childhood, it is so, so entangled and difficult to work through. And that's why, even when you maybe have an opportunity to tell, it would be incredibly complicated to try to do that emotionally. And also, that had never gone well for you in the past. So why on earth would you think it would now?
Right. Then never being alone and being isolated from like normal situations. Even my in-laws noticed that. Remember when we talked to them and sat down and kind of gave them a high level view of this, they were like, okay, we've actually always noticed that about your family, that it's literally just like the four of you all the time. And like nobody else, like no friends, no other people, no outside people, like it's just the four of you all the time. So like before they even knew about any of this, they noticed that my family wasn't really quite right.
Well, and I'm just thinking about, you know, so much of what we've heard and talked about since doing the podcast is that there were these really precipitous, like sudden breaks in your family's friendships. Like, oh, you know, this person was my parents' best friend. And then, oops, all of a sudden, gone. For reasons that I don't quite understand, we're cut off.
Yeah. And that idea that like people that I thought were like the bad guy, right, growing up, now turn out to be the good guys. Like I've had to do a real paradigm shift here with doing the podcast and having certain people kind of approach us and approach me and say really kind things or whatever. And I'm like, hang on a second. Like I've been taught literally to hate you. But then when I put that into perspective, it's like, okay, that makes sense. I've been taught to hate you, but you're actually a really decent human being.
Okay. So I'm thinking about a specific thing that came to us that, again, we can cut this if it's too much for you. But, so someone has said that, she noticed ligature marks on your neck and approached your mother about it with concern, kind of pushed in more than just like a one conversation concern. And the next thing that she knew, even though they had been good friends, suddenly they were no longer friends. Yep. And that's a major red flag.
Yep. A lot of people have brought information, maybe not to that extent, to us, but a lot of people have messaged us and said, I knew something was not right with you. I always thought that you were sad and alone. And when I tried to press in, I was just like stiff-armed. And, you know, a lot of people have said that.
Right. So those should be red flags for us going forward. So you couldn't know maybe what you didn't know before. But people listening to this should know that that is a concern. That's not normal. If we have a friend, if a friend came to me and said, hey, I'm worried about your kid. Like something seems not okay. And by mm-hmm. the way, there's this very obvious problem. I would be
all over it.
All over it.
Like all over it.
Right. Help me figure this out.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. If my friend Carla came to me and was like, listen, I noticed this on Evelyn. Don't know if you've seen it, but like, I'm worried. I would be like, okay, get in the car. We're taking her somewhere. We're going to mm-hmm. go do something. Right. Like I would not be like, bye. We're not friends anymore.
Right.
I mean, also cause Carla's my like ride or die, but
everybody needs that friend.
Yeah.
Everybody does.
She adopted a cat for me. So
because you needed another pet.
Oh my God.
Stop.
Listen, I'm still waiting for Stuart. I just don't know why. Like I kept asking my kids if my birthday presents were going to be barking. And they were like, no, mom, stop.
No more pets. No. Sometimes symptoms of domestic violence or intimate partner violence are signs of familial trafficking. If a child is talking about having to make money to pay for things for the family, that should certainly be a red flag. You know, you've also talked about from a very young age that you were told that you had a role to play in helping make sure the family didn't lose everything.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I was told that if I didn't do these things, that the family business would go under, that the family business was going under, which is actually accurate. And in order to save it, these are the things that needed to be done. I, even into my adulthood, was told stories of people showing up on Christmas Day to take our house. And, you know, just so happens that Christmas Day is maybe a day that that things happened. And yeah.
So they used that as a way of gaining compliance or and the trauma bond of keeping you in a place where you were. So cooperative is such a bizarre word because I don't know, can you call it cooperation if someone is doing something through force, fraud, or coercion, but they're not screaming and pounding on the door or the window to get out? Is it really cooperation? I don't think it is. It's not consent. No. Anything short of consent is not cooperation. And so they used all of these ploys to make you cooperate, even though you were not actually consenting. Mm-hmm. Of course, we know a child cannot consent to any of this stuff.
Right.
Compartmentalization, dissociation, and other kinds of trauma responses, right? So the boxes.
Yep.
Ritualistic abuse.
Yep. Check.
Sometimes it can look like things like poor living or working conditions or lack of formal education. Like, we know that that can sometimes be a thing, but please understand there are lots of middle-class suburban people trapped in trafficking, obviously. Being isolated, the family can be isolated from others. So the idea, you can be isolated though, still doing life with other people. Again, going to church, going to work, going to school, you can be isolated by people being cut out of your life suddenly, mm-hmm. for sure.
Yep.
So lack of opportunities that most kids have opportunities to participate in. So I don't know. Did you do?
Like- no. Yeah. I didn't play like sports. I didn't do things. It wasn't, there was really not any extracurriculars other than church. And church to me looked like we go to church on the outside, but while this event at church is happening in the building, in another part of the building, I am being bought and sold. There was not really, I didn't really do very many things.
So there weren't things outside of, again, that controlled environment.
The things that were outside of it were part of it. Yeah. So it was like, okay, yes, we go to church because that's a great place to be able to just like facilitate these things. So it was really just like anything that I did was only like a matter of whether or not it was a useful situation to them. I didn't like play like sports because I wanted to play sports. I didn't dance. I didn't do any kind of, I was in gymnastics for like 1 minute and then I remember getting yanked out of it. So,
which if we put that in the context of a familial trafficking person who is being controlled, a parent is not going to want their child to be where they're going to meet outside adults who aren't part of the system.
Right.
Because they might find out.
Right.
An inability to grow up. So kids in a family-controlled trafficking environment, the parents are going to keep them controlled as long as possible, long past the time when it is appropriate.
Yes.
They live at home way later. They don't have often, they don't have normal progress into adulthood.
Right.
Fear of medical providers and other helpers.
Yes. Like I said, I just literally stopped going to doctors. I have a very irrational and unhealthy fear to this day of, I mean, like literally last night I was talking to my sister-in-law about like stuff and she was like, you just need to make an appointment. And I'm like, I know, but that's like a lot easier said than done. Like it's literally ingrained in me to not. And like when I do, it's so hard to even again, as an adult, I'm 35 freaking years old. And it's still hard for me to not go in there and be like, I'm so good. How are you? You know, that's like, I can't, but that's very hard then to get help that I need for things. Because if I'm just telling them that I'm fine, then why would they help? Right.
Right. And that was programmed into because you were not supposed to be telling.
Right. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Yeah. It's, and like I said, I was never alone. And then when I was like, it was just wildly inappropriate for me to not be alone, I just didn't go.
Right. Right. So. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And by the way, because of the lack of education in the medical community, you have had a mixed bag of responses. I feel like the most success we have had is when I write a letter informing the medical provider mm-hmm. of why you're there.
Yep.
And they can kind of preemptively understand mm-hmm. so that when you're talking about it, they're not like, wait, what? And then asking you to talk about trauma things mm-hmm. when you're already freaked out.
Yeah. And again, because I am so, I could literally have like broken, a whole broken body and still walk into the emergency room and be like, I'm generally fine. If you could just help with this one thing, like that's just... it's literally just ingrained in me. Although Patrick might disagree with that because one time I had a gallbladder attack and I was laying in the waiting room screaming at people. So.
Well, that hurts a lot.
It does. It
it's kind of so curious bad. To me though. Like what made that different? But, okay. Maybe because it was totally separate from all this.
Yeah.
Okay. Know. That's a different box.
Well, it was because it was unmanageable. Anything that's manageable is just not an issue. But that was unmanageable.
You learn to just keep going. Mm-hmm. So another more red flag, when there's secrecy around the house, like areas of the house that are off limit to outsiders. Mm-hmm. Ooh, is that familiar?
Yeah. Again, people have actually reached out to us. People were in my house pretty often because my mother ran, this is cringeworthy, but my mother ran a small preschool in our home. And so a lot of people have been like only really from point A to point B in my house, not like throughout my house, but they would come in the front door, walk down the hallway, through the kitchen, down to the basement. That's where the preschool was. But the basement was split in half. So half was the preschool and half was not. And these preschoolers who are now adults have come to us and said, oh my gosh, like I remember like doors in the basement that we were never, ever allowed to go through. We were never allowed to go into that room. Small sectioned off rooms. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So make sure we're all clear that what was behind those doors was a place where abuse happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes. So a lack of understanding about your changing body and developmentally appropriate things can be a red flag. So if you're being trafficked in your family, that they're probably not providing appropriate education around some of those things.
Nope. I figured that out by myself.
Right. And yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Substance dependency within the family without an obvious means to pay for it. Right. So yeah. Where's the money coming from? Attachment disorders. So the struggle to get close to other people. So I think we need to talk about the psychological and emotional realities of when it is a parent or caregiver who is the person trafficking a child. So honestly, I can't even remember if I ever talked about this brain science piece back when I was talking about other brain science pieces, but I will now. So what we know is that, so first off, all the neural connections in our brain are built based on use in our very early years. So when we're born, all the basics of what our brain needs is there for things like breathing, sucking, swallowing, sleeping, all of that basic functioning stuff. All of those neural pathways exist at birth. But everything else, language, motor skills, connection and attachment, reading social cues, all of everything else is built based on use. Which is a really important thing to understand, because what happens when, from a very, very young age, a child is in chronic flight, fight, freeze? There's, and I did talk about some of that stuff, I know, when I talked about trauma and memory. The reality is that there are some very serious impacts on the brain, and our brain is now wired, the child's brain is now wired for trauma responses. That's a very important thing to understand. The other thing is that we have two opposite neural pathways that end up activated when a child is being traumatized by a caregiver. So we have one neural pathway in our brain that is very, very fundamental to our functioning. It is the neural pathway that prompts a child to draw near to an attachment figure, right? That's a very basic survival thing. A child, should we want our children to seek to be near to us so that we can keep them safe and train them and comfort them and all the things that good, caring parents do. We want children to be drawn to us. That is a neural pathway that exists in our brain that prompts children to draw near to their attachment person. We also have a neural pathway that says, run away from danger, which we all understand that, you know, when we are frightened, the natural inclination is to escape or evade. That makes tons of sense. So we have one neural pathway that says, come near to your attachment person. But when the attachment person is also terrifying, there are two very opposite neural pathways activated at the same time. That is unique to trafficking, to abuse that happens within a caregiver's context. So to understand that someone who is traumatized as an adult or traumatized even as a child, but outside the attachment relationship, that looks very different. And it, therefore, again, a child or a person who is trafficked outside a parental or caregiver experience, the impact is very, very different. There is very real brain science impact when it happens within a caregiver relationship. There is a fracture that happens. We cannot have two opposite neural pathways firing at the same time and have there not be a fracture that happens. We can't exist in that space. We can't draw near and run away at the same time. It's just really important to realize that it's also... Okay. I don't know. I guess you want to comment on any of kind of that whole, you weren't even listening to me, were you?
No, brain I science, am. You I zoned am. Out. I am. No, I am. And to be honest, I'm a little bit like, I'm trying not to like just shut down because I like whenever, okay. So whenever we talk about brain science, and we can cut this if you want to, but whenever we talk about brain science and you can explain in terms the things that I have experienced my entire life, it makes me want to just shut down because it's like, I don't know. It's that feeling of like, I'm not crazy. This is real. You know, not that I don't know that, but it's like that feeling of like,
it's not just me. It's not, yeah, it's just, not just because. Me.
Yeah. Like that whole concept of you can't have two opposite things. You can't be close to your parents and also want to run away from your parents at the same time. I mean, that's literally, I'm still fighting that sometimes. I'm still fighting those, you know, like I'm thankful that they're not currently in my everyday life, but also I wish I had parents, you know, mm-hmm. It's that. So yeah, I just find myself kind of shutting down a bit with your brain science. Yeah,
no, I get it. And I imagine that you also really resonate with that feeling of like longing to be near to them, but then, and then that kind of repeating experience, yes, of like, I go near because I so want, I need, yes, you. You're my parent. I'm a child and I, yes, need you. But when I do that, now I get hurt.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And that feels, of course, why would you want to, of course you want to shut down.
Right. So yeah, it's just, yeah. But so yeah, we can keep going. I'm sorry that I zoned out for a sec.
Totally makes sense. Totally makes sense. So I, you know, I think, so let me again comment that a lot of these things that I'm going to share are things that are in the literature. So if you go out there and you read the literature on family-based trafficking, you will find some of these things. And these are things that Kate and I have talked about over long periods of time. So it's not like we're just making this up as we go along. This is documented. Yeah. People just don't talk about it.
That I find crazy though, is that like, and we'll talk about this, I think, further down, but that it's always hard for me. It's hard and freeing and like all of the feelings, right? When we put words to what I've been feeling for decades, right? So like that whole concept of, just all of this. It's like even the idea of like labeling it as trafficking is like, holy crap.
Mm-hmm. Another red flag when there seems to be mind control or like programming to think a certain kind of way. That was certainly your mm-hmm. life experience.
Indeed.
Indeed. Okay. So a lot of the literature when, you know, you again read the scholarly articles about familial sex trafficking, so we are growing to the place where there is some training being done for law enforcement, medical professionals, therapists, about trafficking. But there really hasn't been a lot of attention paid to in those assessments that are available to the fact that a trafficker might be a parent. Mm-hmm. A comprehensive assessment by the Polaris Project, the questions about the sex trafficker are clearly based on the assumption that the trafficker would be a boyfriend or a pimp and not a parent. So there isn't even an opportunity for somebody to talk about that. Supposedly one of the first validated screening tool to identify adult and minor victims of sex and labor trafficking, it was validated on a predominantly foreign-born sample, and it doesn't include any questions that would appear to uncover trafficking of a child when the trafficker is a parent or a guardian. So obviously that's a problem. Mm-hmm. There's also an ongoing issue with labeling familial sex trafficking as child abuse, sexual abuse, without acknowledging the commercial part of that. And so people are being, even if they by some miracle are being charged with a crime, they're certainly not being charged appropriately. Mm-hmm. And often the system will charge a parent or accuse a parent of neglect. So if a child is being trafficked, the parent may be charged with neglect, as if the parent wasn't paying enough attention to keep the child safe, but they're not being charged as if they are actually the abuser,
right, or complicit.
Mm-hmm. Right. So the problem with parents being accused of neglect as opposed to abuse is that the approach to a neglectful parent is fundamentally different than an approach to an abusive parent. So in my infancy of my career, I worked for Child Protective Services in Massachusetts. And so I can say with confidence that if we are approaching a family who is being alleged to have neglected their child, so as in the child has been subjected to an act of omission, care is not being provided, protection is not being provided, education, medical care, basic safety things, food, whatever. If neglect is being alleged, the focus is like behavior and case management. Oh, like you don't have food for your child. Well, let's get you to a food pantry. Oh, you're having trouble getting your child to school. Okay, well, let's get you some help with that. Oh, you don't have a house. Let's get you housing, right? Those kinds of things. Let's get you parenting skills so you know that you have to respond to your child when they cry. Okay. So where there's neglect, families get services to improve their ability to cope and their functioning, and then children are returned to their care, right? When there's abuse, so when there are acts like of commission, something is being done to a child, physical abuse, sexual abuse, sex trafficking. When it's named that and labeled that, services are more likely to be trauma specific, which of course is much more appropriate. If a child is being sex trafficked by a family, acting like this was like a, oops, I, you know, just wasn't paying attention, is not reasonable or appropriate. But that is the reality. So it's important that we call what is happening to a child in a familial trafficking situation. We need to call it the right thing, because families who have trafficked a child should never, ever get another chance to parent. So I have to have a little rant about family reunification. So the really hard reality is that there are just some people who should never get another chance to care for a child, because they are so toxic and dangerous that rehabilitation, maybe they can be rehabilitated and that they can like function in society, but they should never get another chance to have access to a vulnerable child. Unfortunately, our culture in America, children are treated more like a possession than a person, in that they are, the default position is reunification, that a parent only loses permanent custody of a child, rights to their child, through a very, very arduous, long process. And the expectation is always, the onus is on the government to prove that they have done everything possible to make it possible for a family to successfully care for their child. It is the responsibility of the system to make sure that that happens, not the responsibility of the parents. And very often children are returned to the care of parents because the system has not been able to prove that the parent can't care for them, or the system has not been able to prove that they did everything they could to give the parent a chance. So honestly, the horrible thing is that sometimes everybody knows that the parent can't care for the child, but the only way to prove that is to put the kid back with the parent and let the parent fail. Again, by the way, like, this is already a situation often where the child has been removed because the parent is not caring adequately for the child. So the parent has always already shown that they can't provide for the child's needs, or that the parent is abusive. But now the government can't prove that they still aren't able to. So now the child gets returned. That's crazy. That should not happen, but it happens all the time. So it's especially a problem if a child has been sex trafficked within their family, and we're calling it neglect, because neglect is a whole lot harder to prove in many ways. And the belief is that, well, this is more of a benign thing, like, oh, you just needed information or you needed services. That is not what sex trafficking is in a family. These are acts of commission, and anybody who would sex traffic their child should never, ever get another chance.
Well, I also, can I comment that especially in family controlled trafficking, and especially in my specific story and a lot of stories that we've read and heard about of kids, now women, who have come out of this, it didn't really look like neglect from the outside. I mean, I had really nice clothes to wear. I lived in a really middle-class suburban neighborhood.
I went on vacation.
I had enough to eat. I wasn't malnourished. I wasn't, I didn't have like dental work issue. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't have kind of all of those indicators that like I wasn't eating well. I wasn't, you know, I didn't have a safe place to sleep. I didn't have, you know, whatever. So again, that's a really tough thing to even identify in these situations, because from the outside, I looked like a really normal kid, which is kind of our whole point. But yeah, so yeah.
So it is very important that we are paying attention in, so many people listening to us are not teachers or medical providers or therapists or law enforcement. Many people listening to us are just regular folks walking through life. And it is really important for both of those groups of people to be willing to consider the possibility that sex trafficking is happening here. And, you know, to reiterate what we said last time, that, you know, a lot of us are becoming more aware that child pornography is a thing. And then to make the mental leap, as hard as it is to say, that if a child is now being involved in child pornography, where they're being recorded, somewhere along the line, there is a caregiver who is making that possible. And by definition, that is familial sex trafficking. Mm-hmm. So we have to be willing to see it and know that it exists. We have to be prepared to not be put off.
Yeah. And thrown by that word trafficking. I think that is kind of the point of these two episodes, is that that word throws people into this, like, well, wait a second, because like we said in episode one, wait, you're not from Cambodia though, right? And were you homeless? No, you weren't homeless. Are you addicted to drugs? No. Then that doesn't make any sense, because that is the idea that we all have, professionals and unprofessionals alike. That's the idea of trafficking that we have. And we need to kind of be brought up to speed on that this is a whole different type of trafficking that's out there and that's happening.
I also have to say, like, one of the things that like people kind of comment on, how is it that you laugh about these serious things? And that for some people that makes it, I don't know, harder for them to believe this could all be true. I think sometimes the other thing that makes it harder is because you are so functional. And I think sometimes people are like, okay, hold on. So if you really went through all of these horrible things, you should be a drug addict or homeless or whatever, and you're not. So I don't know. Could it really have been that bad? Right. And I think there have been times where I have to be careful about saying how amazing I think you are, because very quick on the heels of maybe feeling encouraged by that, you feel like, oh, wait, now are you going to start to think maybe it's not true? Mm-hmm. Right. So,
yeah, I honestly, like, again, this is a whole other tangent, but in terms of like what we've talked about with some of the services that are out there, some of the things, the ways to get help if you are being trafficked, being what they are, honestly, I think to myself, like, it'd be easier if I was a drug addict. It'd be easier if I was homeless, you know, because then it would just be so obvious, and it would be so like, oh, and now we just usher you into these things, and that's how you get safe, and that's how you get help. It's actually, and there's a lot that people don't see. I think that's also, I was talking to somebody recently, someone at my job had found the podcast via social media and approached me about it. And I had to be very clear that I have a work headspace and I have a other headspace, and they are not privy to that other headspace that I, you know, it's the boxes. Unfortunately, I still live in boxes. So,
and I guess I want to emphasize that, just like, you know, you don't get to judge Kate, about how she does this podcast, because until you've walked a mile in her shoes, it's also not fair to, like, that's like a no win then for a survivor of like, oh, great. So you have worked so hard to overcome and to have a healthy and functional life. And now we're going to take all of that hard work, and now we're going to interpret that as, oh, well, maybe that means that it's not true. Like, okay,
Yeah, it is a no-win situation, because if I'm homeless and a drug addict, then people say, oh, well, you know, she's a drug addict. So
What do we know?
Right. Right. But if I'm not, if I'm functional and I have a job and I have a family, then people say, well, then could it really be true? So, like, what is it that, like, I sometimes have asked myself, like, what is it that I have to be? What do I have to look like and be and sound like to get the help, to get out, to get free that I need, right? Like, what is that? Like, that whole part of me that wants to just strive to do all the things and be all the best, like, thinks that that's the right thing to do. Other parts of me, like, I don't, it's just, yeah, what do I have to be, basically? Right. Which is also a trauma response, because that is basically how I survived.
All right.
Just tell me what to be.
Yep. And so I'm here to say, it is not your responsibility to be any certain kind of way. It is our responsibility as the people who are out here able to help and care. It is our job to see it when it's there and to meet you where you are and to give you whatever it is that you need to be able to get free. The end. So
thanks for being that.
Yeah, I'm all about it. I know. So thank you all for listening. Yeah, stay tuned. We will be back with more episodes. That just sounds like a very bad commercial. Okay, maybe we'll cut that. Okay. I never know how to end.
I know, me neither. On that note,
we're so awkward about starting.
Okay. You know what? You know what we're supposed to say though is
what?
Just remember to like us on Instagram, Facebook, and to visit our website. And
oh yeah, can I say?
Yeah.
Like our website actually has transcripts on it at this point. So
yes,
if you know someone who won't listen but will read the episodes, they're not all there, but a lot of them are.
There's
there.
Also like episode recaps. So even if they like are even lazier, I'm just kidding. But even if they don't have time to read all the there is also summaries on there. There's some great things on our website. So honestly, check it out. And just remember to keep sharing. So, yeah.
Okay. If you or someone you know is stuck in a trafficking situation and needs help, please reach out to the National Human Trafficking Hotline by calling 1-888-373-7888 or text HELP, H-E-L-P, to 233-733.